you don't get the context behind and the many, many decisions that they've made before they come to that point to decide, like, I'm going to leave my home and my country and make this treacherous journey, possibly die on the way. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, to come to that point, you've got to make a series of very serious decisions that we so often don't hear about in the discussions or debates about what's happening.
Because you've always taken such charge.
You are listening
to the Border Chronicle.
Are you an inventor or do you know an inventor?
Hello, welcome to the Border Chronicle. I'm Melissa Del Bosque and I'm here with
Todd Miller.
Yes, and we are the Border Chronicle, context and analysis from the U.S.-Mexico border with a border perspective, and happy to be here today. We're doing something a little different here at the Border Chronicle. It's Todd and I. We're actually in the same room together in downtown Tucson. So we're here. We're going to catch up on everything that's happening at the border because things are moving really really fast in this presidential election year. And we thought we'd sort of double back to our predictions from January that it was going to be a very bumpy ride for border communities. And we predicted correctly. It looks like Trump is going to be the Republican nominee for president. And we all know how that goes. I mean, he's already using, Nazi language and immigrants are polluting the blood of America and so forth. And Democrats seem to be moving to the right in terms of their policies and migration. So I thought Todd and I would come together and sort of talk about what we're seeing now. You know, we're recording this at the end of March and what we sort of see happening in the future and what we wish would be getting covered and talked about that is important, we think, to border communities and the overall discussion about migration and asylum seeking. And so one of those big issues is actually water, right? Because we're approaching summer, and last summer was just really harrowing with water shortages, the Rio Grande drying up. And so Todd's just come back from a big water conference in El Paso and is working on a book about water and the Rio Grande. And so I was hoping Todd could talk a little bit about what he saw there at the conference and what he's been doing in terms of reporting for his new book that will be coming out.
Yeah, I'm just getting back to Tucson from this water conference that I went to earlier this week. And this we're recording and on, I can't even remember the days are blending in. What is the week of March 21st?
Yeah. We made it through St. Patrick's Day, yeah. And now we're approaching April Fool's.
Wow.
So we're in between St. Patrick's and April Fool's right now.
So I'm the big April Fool here as I try to figure out what dates. But anyhow, it's World Water Week, and in El Paso, they dedicated a week a multidisciplinary group of people, organizers within the University of Texas El Paso, UTEP, organized a whole week of events there around water. And it's super interesting to be there in this, as Melissa was just saying, in this election year with, the tension mounting seemingly, right? And all these narratives in going left and right. And that kind of bumpy ride that we were talking about in January, and seeing this, happen before our eyes. And then to go and talk to all these people that are from both sides of the border in Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, primarily about water and water issues, climate change, this kind of severe droughts. I believe somebody, one of the panelists that I, one of the experts that spoke at the conference said that the drought, the severity of the drought right now is, you have to go back to 720 or it's a drought of historic proportions.
720
AD, I guess.
In our year of the Lord, 720?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's so they're saying that this drought is on, we haven't had a drought like that, like this since 720.
I'm remembering, I might have the exact year wrong, but I have to consult my notes, of course.
Yes.
But the 720 is what I remember, and it was something in the three digits, right? So we're talking about a mega drought, and a mega drought that is hitting the borderlands. It's often something that is not quite discussed as much, especially now, right? You're in this campaign year. You have Trump. The 2 weeks ago, there were the quote unquote competing visits of what we presume will be the presidential candidate, Trump and Biden. Trump was in Eagle Pass and Biden was in Brownsville.
Mm-hmm.
And the narratives that come out of it, it's the kind of the usual, right? And a lot of what I believe Melissa would call border theater.
Yeah. Definite border theater.
And in that kind of border theater, these huge issues that underlie a lot of things, such as water, such as climate, such as a host of other things. In this case, I was looking at water, or we were looking at water. Those are huge issues of access to what people in Mexico are always saying, agua es vida, right?
Mm-hmm.
Water is life. And right now, just to give you a little political context to it, and then I'll stop talking about it. But the Mexico on a 5-year it's a cyclical payment of every 5 years, according to a 1944 treaty between the United States and Mexico, has to deliver a certain amount of water to the United States. And in what I've been working on in a book project is looking at conflicts that happened in 2020 around these payments, in which Mexico is going to ship huge quantities of water to the United States and take away literally the irrigation water from farmers. And there's an uprising of small farmers in Chihuahua, central Chihuahua, and the militarization of the dams. Now, in 2024, we're almost at that 5-year mark again in 2025. And the tension is building. There's politicians on the U.S. side saying Mexico is underpaying its water, has not been paying its water debt, while this huge drought is going on, and these tensions, which I would call, we talk about with climate change the idea of a water war or water battles. I think we have one right here, right before our eyes, right in our experience, but it's kind of hidden, right?
Yeah.
It's hidden under these other narratives.
Right. It's a slow-moving water war that's building and building as we choose not to pay attention to it, right?
Yeah, and then at the same time, I'm sure like any listener that's had those moments of all of a sudden you have no water, right? Like I've had that happen a couple times, living abroad especially. You go to the faucet and all of a sudden there's no water. And then, oh my God, like when you can't do that, those basic things that often are taken for granted, then it goes from completely ignored to like, holy shit.
Huge crisis all of a sudden, as if it just arose out of nothing, right? And I mean, you talk about 2020, this last time, and there were shootings and there were riots at the dams with the farmers because it was literally cutting off their lifeblood. Like it was a do or die situation for them. And things got pretty, really intense.
Yeah. People were arrested. People were killed.
Yeah.
For this book, I interviewed a survivor who was shot 4 times by the National Guard, once in the head, and his fiance died. But in his case, he survived with lots and lots of it. Yeah, of course, he's struggling. But yes, I mean, it's a literal, what we've seen is, now what is it? Is it a glimpse? Are we looking into the crystal ball into the future? We're seeing a conflict where water is in the middle of it, and bullets have been fired, and also fired by the state.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, because I want to pivot now to Senate Bill 4, which Texas passed, which would allow state police to arrest immigrants and deport them. And it's currently been stayed by the Court of Appeals, but the Supreme Court was going to allow it to go forward, which is different from what happened when Arizona did something similar in 2012, the Show Me Your Papers law.
SB 107.
Yeah, which was a huge deal. I remember it was an epic battle, and Supreme Court ruled in favor of the federal government, you know, because the federal government has jurisdiction over immigration, as it should, because if each state starts doing its own immigration policies, then it's just going to be a complete and total mess. So Mexico's already said, we're not going to take the people that Texas deports. You know, we're not going to do that. And then on this other hand, you have this impending water issue coming up, right, where Mexico needs to pay its part of the water debt. So we have these two things, you know, happening that's probably going to come to a head, you know,
in the
next few months.
You can look at projections of future migrations coming from places like the Pentagon, the U.S. Pentagon, who look and look at scarcity of water. They identify it as a root cause as to why people might be displaced or come north. I even talked to an expert in Chihuahua, a climate expert. I asked, if this continues like this with these droughts, what will happen? And she told me, quote unquote, everyone will have to migrate.
Yeah, and I think that is the real problem now with border coverage in the U.S. is that there's no big picture, there's no context, there's no analysis. It's more like horse race, you know, like Greg Abbott did this, and now there are less migrants coming, and they're going to California. And it's like, well, guess what? Migration patterns change all the time. And little of it usually has to do with, you know, the U.S. side exactly. I mean, there are complex reasons why those pathways change over time. And so much of it has to do with what's happening in Latin America, which we don't cover. You know, we don't have that context.
It's amazing. It's almost like when I see some of the coverage, it's like, oh, people just arrived to the border out of a complete vacuum.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a UFO was floating overhead, right, and just, you know, dropped them there or something.
Yeah. Any sort out of like void. Reasons why there's so many reasons. There's so many, often multifaceted. They're so humanizing to learn about people and their families and even the very intimate decisions people make to go north or to cross borders or to move away from the place they love, their communities, their homes.
Yeah, and a lot of the coverage and the rhetoric does not focus on that agency or the humanity of the people who are migrating, right? They're just portrayed as these sort of faceless, you know, from a right-wing perspective, they're invaders. And then from the left-wing perspective, they're victims without any kind of agency or something. Often.
Yeah. And both cases are not like, you just see them as numbers, right?
Or yeah.
Flat.
Yeah. You don't get the context behind and the many, many decisions that they've made before they come to that point to decide, like, I'm going to leave my home and my country and make this treacherous journey, possibly die on the way. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, to come to that point, you've got to make a series of very serious decisions that we so often don't hear about in the discussions or debates about what's happening.
Yeah, never
at the southern border, almost never.
We'll hear about our friends, you know, oh, I'm moving, but should I move here, or like some sort of thing where you hear their deliberations and how hard it is even to move within a place where you don't have to cross a border where you're excluded, right? And
yeah,
even that's hard because, oh, I'm leaving this place to go to that place. Just to be able to understand how treacherous this could, or how grueling even those decisions, like when you know, like you just said, you know, that you could risk your life, or your loved ones are risking their lives to do things. And there's so often so much sacrifice as well, like a parent for a child or a child for a parent.
Yeah, and now we have this huge right-wing media ecosystem that I've just watched grow over the years, you know, and it's so huge now. And they're down at the border 24/7. The New York Times just did a piece on all these influencers, American influencers are down in the Darien Gap now, you know, doing sort of selective video and with
you
the right wing
like
narrative.
Ad hoc right wing media.
Yeah, who are putting stuff out on
that are coming to the U.S. border as well.
Well, yeah. These are Americans that are down in the Darien Gap doing, you know, the sort of invasion rhetoric type coverage of look at these, you know, they're doing gotcha interviews with people. Who,
are they doing the same thing where they come in loudly and badly speak Spanish?
Yes, a lot of that is happening. Yeah. And you know, that is coupled with also fundraising, right? Because they've all got like GoFundMes and they're selling merch and they're doing all this stuff. So it's like this sort of, you know, right-wing disinformation echo chamber / grifting merchandising juggernaut where they're making money off of other people's misery. And also, you know, helping the MAGA political movement and Trump, you know, become president, America's first authoritarian dictator, you know, where we haven't even got into like the whole Heritage Foundation 2025 tome that they've put together, which is just like terrifying about what they'll unfurl when, you know, Trump becomes dictator in chief of the United States if he wins.
If.
If. I don't think he can win a general election, but.
I don't know. He did it before. Yeah, he's already doing better than I thought he would do. So, you know, I'm not going to put anything past his way of campaigning and how he brings people in.
Yeah, no, not at all. You cannot underestimate him or just this massive sort of infrastructure that's built up around him.
So this is what's like looking at how the Democrats are responding to this Trump candidacy. I find it really, really interesting. If people remember back to February and that border bill, that the so-called border bill, where it is an emergency supplemental bill, which included funding for Ukraine and Israel, and then about $20 billion for the border. And the interesting thing about that, it hasn't passed. I don't know if it will pass, but that $15 billion of that $20 billion goes to CBP and ICE, right? So $15 billion goes to the enforcement agencies, and the way that it's narrated by the Democrats, it's like a total, it's like a 180 degree turn. If you go back from the 2020 kind of campaigning that you saw from Biden, where at least rhetorically they're saying, well, we're you know, the word humane is used a lot. We're not going to build another foot of wall. None of this is going to happen. And then this border bill was pretty much the Democrats coming together and saying, okay, here's your enforcement heavy package. And then using that rhetorically, like when Biden was in Brownsville a couple of weeks ago, when he said, come on, Mr. I forget what he said, I'm paraphrasing, but come on, Mr. Trump, here's a bill for you. You know, and this is why I wanted to mention this along with the right-wing media ecosystem that you're talking about, because it's really showing how that sets the agenda, right? That's setting the agenda. And now, seemingly, the Democrats, I think, I'm not a fly in the wall, unfortunately, in those meetings in Washington, but it seems like their plan is now to move to the right of what Trump was saying and saying, oh, you don't care about securing the border. And then Trump responds with all his comments about, I forget what he said exactly, but internment camps and mass expulsions of people. And so it seems like this conversation is now getting pushed in further and further into the right, which then, continues to give life to this right-wing kind of media ecosystem that you're talking about. But that's where it seems to go. It's like we're on a Mack truck heading a certain direction in this election year. And I don't see how this conversation is going to veer any other way at this point. It seems like it's kind of entrenched, but I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm calling it the border chaos economy at this point. I think it's a huge moneymaker, right? There's all these private corporations that are getting billions of dollars to do surveillance and sensors and detention facilities. And, you know, that money goes to Democrats, it goes to Republicans. The rhetoric, you know, the Democrats, they didn't offer an alternative narrative when they should have. There was no rhetoric, you know, that they should have engaged in talking about the strengths of immigration, the strengths of diversity. You know, this country was, you know, founded on immigrants, colonized by immigrants. We're all immigrants, you know, unless we're Native American, which we're not. So they really painted themselves into a corner. So the only way they can go now is further right in this sort of race to the bottom, which in turns enriches many, many people, right? And helps political campaigns.
Yeah, that's another super interesting thing, because the company aspect, the industry aspect, the kind of companies that get lots of revenue from this increasing fashion, right? In 2023, there were more contracts given out by the U.S. federal government than in any other year. And if you look at the last, the trends coming pretty much from Obama, slight increases during the Trump years, and then pretty significant increases of contracts going on a yearly basis going to private companies with the Biden administration. And that's just another element of it, because if you start going into things and start looking at things and parsing things and looking at what lobbying, like how certain companies are lobbying, or companies right now, and I would suggest to people looking into the campaign funding and the campaign, this kind of supporting of campaigns and seeing what companies are doing it. We did a report on this in 2020. When I say we, I did it along with the Transnational Institute, which is this kind of global organization that's based in Amsterdam. But we did a pretty thorough report on looking at the campaigns of 2020. And shockingly, I didn't expect to find this, but the Joe Biden candidacy was getting 3 times more from the top border companies in terms of campaign financing, right? So those sorts of I wouldn't argue that they're more pro-Democrat or pro-Republican. I would argue that they're very chameleon. When I'd say they, it's an industry. And they, unlike us, which we might vote for one person or another person, one candidate or another candidate, they can put their money in all candidates and be a win-win. That's what it kind of seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you've been so good at tracking that, the industry and how much money is being spent. And it goes back to the old saying, follow the money, right? Which not enough of that is happening in the border coverage that we are seeing, you know, is follow the money. Like, don't listen to what they're saying. Look at what they're doing and who's funding them, who's backing them. I mean, what I find fascinating about Texas and Abbott and Dan Patrick, who, when you look at what they're saying on Fox News and stuff, it's just some really crazy stuff. I mean, Dan Patrick's like calling for blood in the streets and revolution and all this stuff. And you see, you know, they've just gone further and further to the right. And you see who's backing them, you know, who are their campaign donors. And it's really interesting. It's these billionaires, oil and gas billionaires in Texas, who are also like evangelical preachers. Huh. So they're preachers, billionaires, and they have this very ultra right vision, and they have invested in this over several years, And it's now coming to fruition with what we see happening in Texas and really converging with the MAGA movement. And so, you know, I mean, I worked in the Texas legislature for 5 years, and it's so true. It's always about money and power at the end of the day. And you really have to see who's pulling the strings, because then it makes sense. Like, why, you know, Texas used to be, you know, George W. Bush. It was country club Republicans, and they were all for undocumented immigration because it was about cheap labor for their funders, you know, who were like, you know, the big contractors, general construction guys, and so forth. But now it's become even anti-business in the way they frame their rhetoric, where it's just now full on, you know, pretty much fascist.
I always find it interesting that, you know, that part of the George W. Bush, when you think back to the 2000s, because so on one hand, he had that message, you know, of, you know, we want to welcome people coming, and his brother, Jeb Bush, as well. I remember that. On the other hand, during that time of his presidency, you're seeing the most massive fortification that we'd ever seen at the border, right? With the implementation of DHS and all this new funding going to the border, and the Secure Fence Act, building like 700 miles of walls and barriers, and this SBI net, bringing in all this technology. So it's like you had the rhetoric was going both ways, right?
Yeah. No, you make a good point. It's like, welcome, my friend, but, you know, first you'll have to scale.
Go through the gauntlet.
Yeah, first you may probably die in the desert just to come to the United States to get, like, a low-paying job. Yeah, and now it's just become deadly in so many more ways. Yeah, I guess it's like late-stage capitalism, late-stage prevention through deterrence.
Yeah, I always wonder, is it late stage, right? Because, you know, you think, prevention through deterrence, 1994 for the U.S.-Mexico border, and then Caribbean before that. So how long has it been? We had the 30-year anniversary of Operation Hold the Line in October, I believe it was. Was that? That's right.
Yeah.
And here we are. Is it? That's a really super interesting question to ponder. Is it late stage deterrence? Or are they, or is it a new phase of deterrence? Or you have the asylum? It seems like you can look at the deterrence strategy and see all the stuff going on with asylum seekers, including what people are doing now, crossing the border on foot and trying to turn themselves into Border Patrol. Like, I did a report with Border Chronicle a month or so ago about a snowstorm that came through and how Border Patrol, you know, 5 years or a couple years before, they'd be after the people, right? Because that's what they were doing. But now that people are turning themselves in, wanting to turn themselves into a process or have an asylum claim, well, they're nowhere to be seen, right? The border, this is what the humanitarian aid groups are saying. And if you go down there and see for yourself, it's true. There's people like in makeshift camps and that sort of thing. And it just makes me think of the asylum stuff, all the stuff that went on in the Trump administration, the more and more barriers of to people looking for asylum. And I can't help to think of that as also in the kind of bigger rubric of deterrence, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I just published a piece in the Border Chronicle about an investigation that I did with Lighthouse Reports and two independent outlets at the border, La Verdad in Juarez and El Paso Matters. And the piece that we did, and it was great because it was this binational collaboration, which I wish we would see more of, you know, both sides of the border. Like, you get a much fuller picture of what is happening on the ground. And this investigation was about this really awful, tragic fire in March of 2023, just a year ago. And it already seems like it was so long ago because so much has happened and so much is changing so quickly. But 40 men died in a locked cell inside this provisional temporary, you know, migrant holding facility. And it's interesting because this facility is run by the National Migration Institute, and it was built, you know, in, I think, the mid-90s, right at the time that Prevention Through Deterrence was starting, and NAFTA, right? So since then, you know, this small holding facility has been completely overcrowded, you know, and they're holding people in there for much longer than they should be held.
Do you know
how
many people they normally hold in there, or were holding in there?
They've changed it over time. It used to be just, you know, I don't want to, it's, I think it's in the piece, because I don't want to, I don't have it off the top of my head, but at the time of the fire, they had 67 men locked in the cell. Earlier in the day, they'd had twice that amount, and they're supposed to only have like 60 in there at most. And there was not enough food, there was no potable water, there was no toilet paper, and, you know, so people are being held in there, and with worse provisions than you would have in a prison. And not surprisingly, you know, some of the people being held were protesting. They lit some of their mats on fire. They have these sleeping mats that are stuffed with foam and lined with vinyl. And they, so the toxic smoke filled up the cell.
Were they protesting the conditions?
Yeah, they were protesting the conditions and threats of being deported. You know, they were Venezuelans, Colombians, Guatemalans, all in there together. And a lot of, this was during Title 42, so a lot of these folks had just been pushed back from
so
the U.S.
A lot of them across the border and then...
been pushed back mm-hmm. into Mexico, you know, denied any chance at asylum. A lot of them were traveling with, you know, their families, but the men were separated from the women in these different cells. And they didn't open the cell. They let the men suffocate to death.
How long had those men been in the cell, do you know? Or was it Barry, like some had been in there?
Well, some of them had been in there for a day. Some had been in there, yeah, for about a day or two.
So very temporary. Right?
Yeah, right. They're only supposed to be held for 36 hours, but a lot of people were in there longer than that and waiting to be let out, but were not let out. And that was another problem there as well. And so the question was, how could you not open the cell when you hear people being
In your investigation, did you get video footage of showing?
So we have, in the investigation, we have CCTV footage from inside the facility. We have the investigative documents. It's an ongoing investigation. There's been 11 people criminally charged, including the head of the National Migration Institute, who, oddly enough, is still running the institute and is not in jail. Surprise, surprise. But, you know, the question was, why were they not released? And so the official narrative was that there was no key there, that the man who had the key was not at the facility when the fire broke out. But in analyzing the CCTV footage, and we looked at, you know, 16 hours of footage, the key never left the facility. It's there. So somebody made that call to not open that cell. We don't know who still. And we also documented the fact that there were like missing fire extinguishers or fire extinguishers that didn't work. The exits had been blocked up. I think in the act of sort of expanding the cell so they could fit more people in, they walled off some old exits that could have been utilized, you know, to save lives. And so it was very clear from the setup that there was no concern whatsoever for the people being held under lock and key, as if in prison, you know, which goes back to this sort of like late stage capitalism prevention through deterrence now, where increasingly we're just seeing deaths skyrocketing in all different ways, you know, people drowning, people dying in detention, people dying in the desert, and this continuing sort of disinformation and dehumanization. You know, it's like if you paint them as invaders, people who are coming to attack us, and it's okay if they're dying, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, why would you let an invader live?
Right. Right. And that really helps to build up that whole authoritarian type of government.
It's also interesting, like, to see, like you mentioned, this facility or prison. I don't know anyone using a euphemism like a facility.
Yeah,
like prison is in Mexico, and it was built in the 1990s, kind of coinciding with the deterrence. And it makes me think of, like, there's this fire, and we're already seeing record numbers of people dying crossing the border in the last couple of years. If you look at people, the deaths in Arizona, or I think it might be border wide, they've gone up considerably in the last couple of years, which shows, right, that the deterrence strategy is in place, and that's only the remains that are recorded and found,
right.
And then there's this stuff happening, like, in the detention center that are outside of the U.S. border.
Mm-hmm.
And the detention center fire, which will be probably, associated with Mexico. And then all the stuff that goes on in Mexico, you have the Madres de los Desaparecidos that are, every year they go looking, they do a caravan looking for lost loved ones who have, mainly their mothers from Central America, and they look for their lost loved ones who, they disappeared in Mexico. Like, the disappearances of people and people searching for lost loved ones makes me think that those numbers that we use for people dying by the border itself, right? Oh, they only count if they're in the United States. But without looking at this gigantic sort of enforcement bordering ecosystem, I guess you could call
it.
That goes really far, including to the Darien Gap. And you see, like, this humanitarian disaster, right,
mm-hmm,
happening constantly, like, before our eyes. But then, like you're saying, then it gets put into this border narratives that we get, like, regurgitated constantly.
Which is just this really oversimplistic border narrative that just dehumanizes people.
And then that dehumanization just allows it to keep going. And if you don't know, like... It seems like reluctantly we hear about the people dying. Like, if it was more well known, if it was, people often bring up the point, well, if there were 1,000 French people who died crossing the border last year, wouldn't there be a more, talk about that?
Yeah, huge outcry if
right.
that happened. Yeah,
and that's another. This is so amazing that this sort of when you look at the border as a brutalizing force, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the end all of a brutalizing force is killing somebody, right? And yet, this is not, like, you don't hear it in these back to the campaign election year. You don't hear people talking about it.
No.
Like, saying this is what it does to people.
Yeah. No, it's just wild to me how the entire reality is just being missed, right? And we're just locked in this really simplistic right-wing narrative that's really just taken over and unfortunately is happening around the world. I mean, this is a sort of global thing that's happening, and the U.S. tends to look at itself as this it only looks at itself, right? And not seeing, like, the larger picture globally of what's happening, because in the UK, they have their Stop the Boats campaign, where they're basically drowning people in the channel as they try to approach the UK from France. And, you have Orban in Hungary who's beating people back at the border physically, harming people. So it's something that's happening around the world as people around the world are migrating, And so we go back to the summer, right, as Mexico is getting more and more pressure to pay back its water debt, at the same time the U.S. is going to be desperate for Mexico to hold people back. So that's going to be an interesting debate there between the two countries, and I predict that Mexico is going to get whatever it wants from the U.S. because I think Biden is so desperate to just keep people back so that's not an issue for him in the election. There's going to be a lot of behind the scenes, I think.
You mean, like, keep
dialogue.
People back, like Mexico will rev up its enforcement even
yeah.
more.
Even,
about people,
even,
people
even
crossing
more.
People.
Yeah, even more.
Because and I remember when it really revved up in 2014, it was already, there's already always been like this. That's another question I have for you about the kind of U.S. in the detention center in Juarez with where the fire happened. In the piece, you mentioned that the U.S. might have been involved in, you know, some financing or partially financing or something.
I mean, well, the U.S. is definitely involved in supporting Mexico's massive immigrant detention system. You know, I mean, we did that piece with Belen Fernandez, right, who got stuck in like Mexico's largest.
The siglo XXI.
Yeah, which has the dystopian name of 21st century, is Mexico's largest detention center, where she was
Tapachula.
Yeah, so I predict the summer is just going to be really intense.
I'm curious, because Mexico has had those big operations, like they had the one in 2014, the Frontera Sur, the southern border, and it was I remember, because I went and reported on it at the time. I went to Chiapas, and you viscerally saw the revving up of enforcement of the Guardia Nacional. No, that was before the Guardia Nacional at the time, but there was, you see the immigration and the police kind of running these joint operations and going into towns and raiding hotels and that sort of thing. I'm curious, like, going off what you're saying, if we're going to see another, because the Plan Frontera Sur, I think technically still exists, but I've heard the offices have kind of disappeared. So I'm curious, like, as we think ahead, maybe to the summer, in the context of the campaigns, is Mexico going to announce another sort of Mexico has its elections as well, right?
Yeah,
so there's that too. But are they going to announce more, like, another plan for the border?
Well, what I've noticed with López Obrador is that they are less transparent now, I think, about the binational programs that they're doing to hold people back. It's harder now to track down the funding, or, like, they used to be very vocal, like you said, about announcing, like, we have this plan.
Yeah.
But now it seems like a lot of this happens behind closed doors, and they just do it. They don't announce it.
More piecemeal.
It's piecemeal. It's hard to track down. I mean, I had a real hard time tracking down the funding that the U.S. is giving Mexico for its detention facilities. I've not been able to find that number. If anybody listening to this has that, knows how we can find out what the U.S. money they're funding.
I'm curious about
Mexican
what
detention.
Agency that goes through, because a lot of the sort of border funding, which I've looked into, goes through the State Department. So the INL, the International Bureau on Narcotics and Law Enforcement, or there's some Department of Defense, because according to the Foreign Assistance Act, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, cannot do foreign assistance. So they have to go through these other agencies, which makes it super difficult to figure out.
Yeah.
Trust me, I like going parsing through these budgets.
And it's become more and more opaque.
Yeah.
Because there used to be, I mean, you and I have been doing this a long time. The places I used to go to find out this information, it's not there anymore. So where is it? You know?
Yeah, is it like, well, I remember I talked to, when I was doing a book looking at externalization of the U.S. border, I went and talked to Adam Isaacson. People probably remember we've done a few Q&As with Adam from...
Adam is great. I mean, Adam really knows so much about what's happening. He's with WOLA.
He's with WOLA. And
NGO.
Yeah, the Washington Office on Latin America. And I interviewed him about this, about, like, U.S. foreign assistance through DHS and their border programs and externalization. And he said, you know, handful of really major ones, but he said there's, like, 100 other, like, what do you have to do to go through those budgets and figure out, like, what little line is going to that, to the border, to, like, a detention center in Juarez or Tamaulipas or Chiapas or Tabasco or, you know, it just seems like a daunting task. So again, we'll put out a call out to any listener who has.
Well, this has been a really great conversation, and I think we should do this more, especially this year as things are moving so quickly. And on this podcast, I'm going to put a button to leave a comment, because I'm hoping that listeners will leave comments about, you know, what are issues you're thinking about regarding the border that you would like answers to, that you would want the Border Chronicle to cover. because there's just so much going on right now. And we really want to focus in on what is important to border communities and helping you get those answers. So we'll hope you listen to the Border Chronicle, read the Border Chronicle, thebordercronicle.com. You can find us online. And we have tote bags, very cool tote bags with our logo, which is a scorpion, which we're very proud of, the Border Chronicle logo, because we are, you know, proud desert dwellers. And a scorpion is a survivor.
And watch out if you get cross a scorpion.
Yeah, so if you want a cool tote bag, we are offering those to founding members. We hope you'll become a founding member of the Border Chronicle and invest in context and analysis and a deeper understanding of what's happening at our southern border. Because honestly, in my more than 20 years of covering the border, I have not ever seen a more impoverished and ridiculous narrative or framework of the way that we're looking at it now, which has just been deliberately, you know, done by this right-wing disinformation ecosystem and, you know, the MAGA movement, unfortunately. They've invested quite a lot in it, and it's certainly paid off.
And also a media system that says this, they kind of tell the same story over and over and over again. And I hate to say it, often miss, like, huge stories, often miss context. And we're at the Border Chronicle are trying to get in those, you know, those angles that need this attention as best as we can. Yeah. So this is another reason to please subscribe, because we want even more reporters.
And yeah, we'd love to hire another reporter so we could really expand our coverage. So it's we want everybody to read and to listen, but the paid subscribers really helps us and supports our reporting and what we can or cannot do. So so call out to folks who want to support the Border Chronicle and what we're trying to do. We really appreciate it.
But the reason why we try to air out, you know, these realities is to really kind of engage with this stuff holistically and be able to, like, instead of going with these faulty, misinformed narratives, well, how can you make any decision about anything if you have wrong information?
Right.
The goal of, like, talking about this stuff is, you know, because we think, you know, or one of the things is that you engaging with this in a correct way could bring actual, honest to God solutions.
Yeah.
To something that just seems like endlessly talked about, especially in campaign years, and becomes a sacrificial lamb, right?
Yeah.
It goes, oh, the border. The political campaigns come to just throw the border to the...
under the bus.
Right.
Every single time. Every single time. So, yeah, we just hope that this is our granito de arena, to come up with some solutions. And for God's sakes, to move on to a more realistic rhetoric and
that comes from the borderlands, that it comes organically from.
So thank you all for listening, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
You've been listening to the Border Chronicle podcast. The Border Chronicle is reported by Todd Miller and Melissa Del Bosque, based in Tucson, Arizona. This episode was edited by me, Steve Heiss. If you like what you're hearing, please consider rating us on your favorite podcast platform. It will help other people find the show. You can read and listen to more local border journalism on our website, thebordercronicle.com.